Welcome back to another edition of the ASEP Equal podcast. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Jason Woods. Today's discussion is going to center around how do you decide what patients are most likely to be fluid responsive when you are resuscitating for sepsis. Now, all of the discussion today centers around already having started your resuscitation, and all of these patients will have already gotten their 30 per kilo boluses that we have talked about in all of our other sepsis podcasts. Once that has happened, if you have a patient who you think may still need some further intervention, how do you go about deciding what patients are likely to benefit from fluids, which patients might be harmed by them, and then what techniques can you use to actually determine that? And that is what we're going to try to address today. Our first speaker today is going to be Dr. Nova Panabianco, who is an emergency medicine physician and an emergency ultrasound expert. She is currently the interim director of emergency ultrasound at the University of Pennsylvania. And today she's going to start by giving us an idea of why do we think we can use the IVC on ultrasound to make any determination? What is the data for it? And then what kind of technique do we need to be aware of, as well as pearls and pitfalls?
One of the things I'd like to promote is the justification for using the IVC as a emergency physician and a resuscitator. Assessment of the volume status can be challenging to assess in some patients, particularly with patients with comorbidities that may have physical findings that don't reflect their true intravascular volume. We know that over and or under resuscitating patients can lead to poor patient outcomes. And in general, it's often difficult to predict who will be volume responsive and who will not be. So the IVC is a capacitance reservoir leading directly into the heart. The bedside ultrasound of the IVC is non-invasive method for hemodynamic monitoring, and assessment of the overall morphology and collapsibility of the vessel can help predict central venous pressures. Now, IVC assessment is really most valuable when it's at the extremes of size, so very, very small or very, very flat, and whether the morphology, which I'll talk about, which is either big like a basketball, flat like a pancake, or somewhere in between. It's important to note that IVC assessment does not stand alone, and that one should always consider examining the heart, at least in one plane, and the lungs to take everything into context. Just like any diagnostic test, it has its own limitations and should not be taken out of context of the patient or the other data that is available. So my disclaimer to you all is that the IVC is not the holy grail of volume status that we had once hoped it was. When many rivers and all individuals started talking about early goal-directed therapy, most of those studies included a central line for assessment of central venous pressures. Historically, we'd also put swans in to assess for pulmonary artery pressures. However, not all patients need an invasive line to have an assessment of their IVC, nor is it useful to always put in these lines that have complications into a patient. So the IVC was one of the early ways to assess somebody's volume status without having to do something invasive. Now, it is prone to several pitfalls. One is that it assumes normal cardiac function and intrathoracic pressure. It assumes that the valves of the heart are normal. And because of this, it fails in the same way that PA catheters and central venous pressures fail. The benefit, as I said earlier, is that it's non-invasive. It is rapidly performed, and it can be repeated over time. So this is a tool that's particularly useful for somebody that who comes in sick, you do an intervention, then you can assess them again. It's certainly something that should not be just one single measurement. And to this point, this lecture oversimplifies the assessment of the IVC, but should give you the basic tools for assessment. So understanding the physiology is important here. So when a person who is normally spontaneously breathing, they have a negative inspiratory pressure in their chest when they take a deep breath. This lowers the right atrial and right ventricular pressures, and at the same time increases intra-abdominal pressures. With that occurring, the blood is drawn from the abdomen into the chest, and it results in a variation of the inferior vena cava. So in spontaneously breathing patients, one could assess the inferior vena collapse index by looking at the IVC in its maximum, which is typically during expiration, then the IVC minimum in inspiration, dividing by that by the max, multiplying by that by 100.
I'll give that formula one more time. You can calculate the IVC collapsibility index by taking the difference between the maximum diameter, which is typically at the end of expiration, and the minimum diameter, which is typically at the end of inspiration. So subtract those, you get a number, divide it by the maximum, and multiply that by 100. And that will give you a percentage change of the IVC diameter as compared to the maximum diameter that it is. And this should give you an idea of just how much indexed to the largest diameter that the IVC is changing during the respiratory cycle.
Now, people are often asking me what is the right number to assess for if this person is hypovolemic or hypervolemic or euvolemic. And there have been numerous studies trying to pinpoint this number and to limited success. So the way I like to think about it is that the inferior vena cava's collapse index and diameter is a continuous variable. And on the extremes, you have more information. So somebody who is collapsing more than 70% is probably on the dry side, and somebody who is collapsing less than 30% is probably on the wet side, assuming that the heart is normal. talking about literature here in a study of 73 patients by Arun Nagdev et al. They looked at IVC collapse index and the CVP pressure monitored by a central line. And they found that if the IVC collapse index was greater than 50%, it was associated with a CVP less than 8 millimeters. In a meta-analysis of 21 articles, the IVC diameter and collapse index demonstrated moderate strength correlations with central venous pressure and right atrial pressures in most studies. And remember, and this is only in non-vented patients. The true holy grail is trying to determine if somebody will be volume responsive. And again, the literature here is less robust. But in a study of 40 non-vented patients with acute circulatory failure, they found that an IVC collapse index of greater than 40% was usually associated with fluid responsiveness. However, a value of less than 40% did not exclude volume responsiveness. So the take-home point is that if the collapse index is greater than 40%, one is likely to be fluid responsive. However, if the collapse index is less than 40%, you cannot predict their ability to be responsive or not.
In addition to the right numbers, I know that getting the appropriate technique can really make a big difference. So do you got any obvious tips for us on how to go about doing this exam or things that people frequently will make mistakes on?
When starting this exam, if you have to choose your transducer, now the curvilinear and phased array transducers are both excellent choices. They have very similar scanning profiles. They're both low frequency probes between 2 to 5 megahertz. They use a sector scanning format. That means when you start relatively a small image and then it goes out to a wide pie shape, it allows for a large field of view. The major difference between these two transducers is the footprint. Now, the footprint is the area where the crystals are aligned, and then the curvilinear or abdominal probe, as some people like to call it, it's a wide footprint or large footprint, good for large spaces. And the phased array transducer has a very small footprint, which is really good for tight spaces. Patient positioning is actually less important than one would think. We did a study here at Penn looking at patients who could not lie flat. These were all dialysis patients. And the question was, does IVC collapse index depend on whether the patient is supine or semi-recumbent. And we found that there was no variation in IVC collapse index based on patient positioning. So if you have a patient who's particularly orthopneic or dyspneic and does not feel comfortable laying flat, you can still perform the exam reliably at a 45-degree angle. Probe orientation is important as well. There are pros and cons to both the transverse and longitudinal plane. For the transverse plane, it is easy to identify the inferior vena cava from the aorta, which sounds like it shouldn't be so hard, but it's not uncommon where people will show me images of what they think is the IVC for volume status, but in fact, they've been measuring the aorta next to it. I feel that the transverse plane is the best way to assess for IVC morphology. So when you cut it in transverse plane, you can see if it's flat, oval, or full. It's easier to stay on midline. There's less swinging side to side, or you can at least watch the swinging so you know if you're on plane or not. However, it is more challenging to assess the distance from the diaphragm. So the way I do it is I look for the hepatic vessels and I try to keep them about a centimeter from the IVC. For the longitudinal plane, that's the way it was traditionally taught, and most research on collapsibility index has been done in the longitudinal plane. It is easier to assess the distance from the diaphragm, and it avoids the pitfalls of structure, external structures compressing the IVC. So hepatic masses, the diaphragm, things that might not be seen in transverse plane are easier to see in longitudinal plane. As far as probe location, traditionally people have scanned at the epigastrium. However, my sneaky point is that you can actually get really good images by coming a little bit lateral to the patient's right and scanning through the liver. This really avoids any bowel gas and is often a much better window for looking at the IVC than the epigastric plane. Some basic anatomy. Well, again, it sounds obvious. The IVC has some challenges in determining it from the aorta. It's always on the patient's right, or most of the time. It tends to enter the diaphragm at much higher as a lone vessel at around T12. The IVC is technically compressible, though I would avoid trying to compress it to determine that from the aorta. It does have thinner walls. And the really big point here is that there really are no branches in the IVC after the hepatic veins. So when you're looking at the IVC, you want to look for the hepatic veins coming in and really see no branches distal to that. If you're seeing branches, you should suspect that you're actually looking at the aorta with the celiac trunk and the SMA coming off. And one of the things that people often will say, well, you can tell the IVC is not the aorta because the aorta will be pulsatile and the IVC is not, but that is actually not true. The IVC is quite pulsatile because there is no valve between the right atrium and the IVC, and then the aorta right next to it is always knocking into the vena cava. Do not use pulsatility to determine which vessel you're looking at. Now, talking about IVC morphology, I try to keep it simple, and I describe a underfilled IVC is going to be flat like a pancake. An euvolemic IVC should be oval like a football, and a plethoric IVC should be more like a basketball, very round. A normal diameter in an adult patient for the intravena cava is between 1.5 centimeters and 2.5 centimeters.
All right. Thanks, Nova, for that great review of why we do this thing and what information we can actually glean from it. I just want to hammer home the fact that you cannot use pulsatility to determine the aorta versus the IVC on this exam. The IVC will typically be quite pulsatile, and this is one of those places where that distinction is not useful. Our next speaker is going to be Dr. Todd Schlesinger, who is an emergency medicine physician and the founding program director for the emergency medicine residency at Aventura Hospital in Florida. Importantly, he is also the lead for the sepsis section of the ASEP Equal Initiative, and so has been participating in and moderating many of the sepsis discussions within the ASEP Equal series. He is going to discuss a couple of other techniques for assessing fluid responsiveness other than the IVC collapsibility index, as well as some techniques that you can use if you don't happen to have access to an ultrasound or one of the other more advanced evaluation mechanisms.
So just as a reminder, why are we talking about assessment? Sepsis, obviously in the U.S., we're all kind of bound by SEP 1, but in the septic shock bundle, in the six-hour part, one of the things that often was missed when we're looking at a lot of the data is the repeat volume status and tissue perfusion assessment. You know, the way SEP 1 says is you have two different ways of doing this. And again, this is sort of later on within 6 hours. So let's all remember that all these patients with severe sepsis or septic shock in this case will have already gotten their 30 cc per kilo bolus, assuming that everyone's completing the measure, right? We know that early fluids are really helpful, early antibiotics. The catch is after that 30 cc's, where are we? What's the fluid assessment? Do we need to give more? That's the stuff we're looking for. So within 6 hours, we have two ways of doing it, right? We either do a focused physical exam, which looks at things like vital signs, cap refill, peripheral pulse evaluation, skin, and then the other is a 2 out of 4.
And those four are central venous pressure, central venous oxygen, a bedside cardiovascular ultrasound, and something that I know is very near and dear to Dr. Schlesinger's heart is either the passive leg raise or a fluid challenge. So Todd, before we jump on into the technique, I wonder if you can help clarify something that I think gets confused frequently and that Nova talked about briefly is the difference between fluid status and fluid responsiveness. Fluid status being what is your overall intravascular volume compared to what you need, and fluid responsiveness being how likely are you to actually get better with it, or if you do something, do you get better with fluid? So is there any definition that you can give us for fluid responsiveness?
Well, I think one of the more accepted, at least research definitions, is that your stroke volume increases by 10 to 15% after getting 500 cc's of fluid. And conceptually, when your stroke volume goes up, since stroke volume is one of the components of cardiac output, you can increase your oxygen delivery to the tissues. And that's the concept of why we're considering fluid responsiveness. But you can't even talk about that unless you're thinking about the Starling curve. And this is the part that ends up giving some drama and causing some controversy. Because for most of us who are in normal function and we have normal ventricular function right now, giving preload will increase your stroke volume and it correlates really well with fluid responsiveness. However, as you get more and more critically ill, especially if there's poor ventricular systolic function, your Starling curve, it kind of flattens out, and giving fluid doesn't really give you that much bang for your buck on a cardiac output point of view.
And then we typically visualize the Starling curve as starting to turn downward at some point when fluid overload becomes an issue, and where giving additional fluid will actually worsen your cardiac output. So let's move on to what sorts of measures we can actually use. I know that one of the concepts that you wanted to talk about first was static versus dynamic measures.
Static measures are sort of like that first thing. It's your vital signs, your cap refill, your urinary output. But I think we all know that depending solely on vital signs isn't really very sensitive. And a lot of times too, especially with things like capillary refill, you lose your inter-rater reliability. Also included with the static measures is your CVP. And when I say that, I'm saying looking at one number in time. Yes, we can trend it, but we do have to remember that the CVP is really more of a measure of preload. It's a reasonably good measure of preload, but just as we saw in the Starling curve, although you may have preload, it's not always predictive of fluid responsiveness. In terms of central venous oxygen, I mentioned it because it's also part of SEP 1. Again, static measure, this doesn't really tell you about fluid responsiveness. Central venous sat's kind of like a lactate, more of a resuscitation endpoint, and not something that we use for that. If you haven't figured it out, I'm not really too into the statics. It's the dynamic measures that have been shown by the literature to show fluid responsiveness. And the biggest one is really the passive leg raise, which honestly is just a surrogate for fluid bolus, right? You could give someone a bolus and then measure and see if they did better. The problem is if we do a bolus every time, at some point we will fluid overload. So the passive leg raise is sort of to bolus without a bolus. But the catch with passive leg raise is when you do it, well, what do you measure? How are you measuring the cardiac output? It's pretty easy to do the maneuver, but now you have to measure something fairly accurately. So as I said, a bolus without a bolus, but how are you going to measure your cardiac output? Probably one of the easier ways and things you can do is IVC collapsibility. But there are other techniques, and that's what I'm going to talk about. A lot of us have all these new fancy machines in our place. Some people have none. So I'm going to go fairly quickly on some of the things that are out there. I'm not going to talk about echo or carotid Doppler flow, because again, that would be more in the ultrasound realm. But interestingly, end-tidal carbon dioxide, fairly non-invasive, something most of us have as a method. And when you look at the different things that increase your carbon dioxide, a simple way of thinking of it is the body's either making more carbon dioxide, but also it has to get from the tissues to the lungs. And so if your output's steady and your ventilation's steady, then the only variable left is the lung perfusion. So under conditions where your lung ventilation's constant and you're assuming, because you'll do this over a short period of time, what's in conjunction with a passive leg raise, in 15 minutes, you shouldn't have a big change in your production of carbon dioxide. And tidal turns out to be a pretty good measurement of pulmonary blood flow, which is equivalent to cardiac output. The number you look for is a 5% difference.
And just to clarify there, because this is certainly a new concept for me, when you are looking for the delta in the end-tidal CO2, after you've done the passive leg raise, which if you remember is going to simulate a fluid bolus, you assume that your cardiac output is going to increase. Cardiac output increases, you're going to increase your delivery of carbon dioxide to the lungs, which should increase your end-tidal CO2 when measured over a brief period of time.
But going back to dynamics, let's say we want to sort of fake a fluid bolus, and for some reason we can't do a passive leg raise, like we can't tip the person down. Another way you can is something called the end expiratory occlusion test. So someone has to be on a mechanical ventilator for this, and they have to be able to tolerate you blocking the tube for 15 seconds. And that's exactly what you do. So you need some sort of measure. So either you're holding the ultrasound and looking at the heart or carotid flow or the IVC, or you have one of these fancier machines that can measure cardiac output fairly quickly. You clamp the endotracheal tube, and by stopping the cyclical impediment of venous return, the preload transiently increases. And if it increases the cardiac output, that indicates fluid responsiveness. But again, they have to be able to tolerate you clamping their tube for a little bit, which most critically ill can do. And I believe you're looking for about, a 5% change there.
And then there's one final method that we wanted to bring up. So if you have a patient who happens to have an A-line and has stable ventilatory status, typically meaning that they are mechanically ventilated, you can measure the pulse pressure at full inspiration and at full expiration. And if they are more than 12% different, they are likely to be fluid responsive. Now, the one caveat to this is that that has only been held to be true at tidal volumes of at least 8 cc's per kilogram. So we can talk in separate podcasts about lung protective strategies and what the correct ventilatory management in these patients is. But if you want to try to use this method and you happen to have a patient who is breathing tidal volumes of that size or larger, this is something that you can use.
There have been a few meta-analyses on this, and not only is it, do you find the fluid responsiveness, but it's actually very sensitive and very specific and probably one of the better things.
And I do want to remind everyone that the references for everything that we talked about, as well as a description of all of these techniques, is available in the toolkit that is on the ASEP Equal website. We had a couple of questions that came in while we were recording this, and the first one is going to go to Nova. Do you have any thoughts on using the IVC evaluation with an ultrasound to guide when you should be done fluid resuscitating and move on to pressors, or when you could continue to give fluids and maybe see some additional benefit?
And, you know, often we'll resuscitate to a full IVC. And if they're still hypotensive at that point, that's when we consider the pressors. So it's really a nice way to assess the tank. If they have a plethoric IVC, but their lungs are still really dry and they're hypotensive, I might still consider giving some fluids, versus if they're starting to get wet, then I definitely back off.
And then finally for you, Todd, what about using smaller volume boluses? If you are concerned about fluid overloading with a 500 cc bolus, can you do something smaller, half of that, or even down to 100 cc's?
A lot of people are trying to advocate the mini bolus, so giving anywhere from 100 to 200 cc's to see if there's fluid responsiveness to that. And that's totally fine, but the issue is you need a very, very accurate measure of cardiac output to go with that. Again, if you're just going to go and do sort of bedside evaluations, you do the little bolus, you're going to be doing a lot of them and a lot of assessments. And that's great to be able to spend a lot of time with a patient, but that's not always the easiest thing to do.
And in summary, this first point is not going to be a surprise to anyone. The ultrasound is your friend. It's a great non-invasive tool for some things. IVC measurement is not the holy grail of deciding who will or will not be fluid responsive, but it is an additional measurement, and the further towards the extremes of collapsibility, the more information it gives you. Remember that a passive leg raise can simulate a fluid bolus, so if you have a patient who you are not sure they could tolerate additional fluids or you just want some additional information on, lay them back and raise their legs up for 15 minutes and then measure with your marker of choice. And we went over a couple of them today. There are more listed on the ASAP Equal site. If you happen to have one of the newer fancy machines that can give you a more detailed evaluation of cardiac output, have at it and use it. As Nova said at the end there, you can consider using ultrasound measurement of the IVC to help guide when you can stop fluid resuscitation, when you may need to start pressures, as well as when the patient may tolerate some additional fluids. And finally, there is some ongoing consideration for smaller volume fluid boluses, but Dr. Schlesinger's point is, if you're going to consider doing that, why not just do the passive leg raise first and then see what you got? And all those listeners out there, thank you so much for giving us your time today. You can find the rest of our ASAP Equal series through the Academic Life in Emergency Medicine feed through Apple Podcasts. You can read our associated blog posts at www.aliem.com. You can find me on Twitter at jwoodsmd or via email at littlepatientsbigmedicine@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening.